One of the dreams we had in the International, and it's been realized, other than the brethren of Poland and France knowing each other, the brethren of European countries did not know each other very well. They were separated, isolated. Now they started having Polish-French-German conventions. The Britons go to France. They have communication there. The Greeks come up to Germany. There's much more contact now between the brethren. And that was really what that was the goal, the International. I think if anything I was involved in my life, that probably was the thing I'm happiest with, the way the International turned out. Still something I look at with great joy that happened. One of the things that happened at Osteich made that convention so special. It was the only international convention that included a wedding. Eva Pichanka and Roger Adams got married there. And that wedding was very delicate because they were, Eva had been in America long enough to like the American-style weddings, which are very different than Polish style, and especially when it came to candles. And I was talking to Brother Michal Kopak, who I developed a special friendship with. And at that convention, talking to Michal, he said, well, they didn't have candles. You want the Polish brother to get up and leave? So they did not have candles. But it was a unique experience having a wedding there. I think it's an experience that should not be repeated. Another memory from Willingham that I remember so well was when I got to the first night, by this time the Polish brethren had taken over the control of the electronics. And what a change. Great improvement. They immediately started with these little radio sets, and it just worked out very, very well. So their team would get there early, get set up. And we got there early at Willingham. And I sat down with these three young Polish brethren, and I was like, how am I going to talk to these three brothers in Polish? Well, I knew Dariusz Grudzień spoke English, so I was speaking to Dariusz in English. As I was speaking to Dariusz, I noticed other two brothers would nod or disagree. I said, you know English. Dariusz Krzywek was one of them, and Daniel Anisa was the other young brother. And that was great getting to know them. We formed a special bond with the Grudzień family, and that became our home base every time we go to Poland. Had many great joys. I was going there once, again by boarding, I caught late getting to the border, and going through Auschwitz, Oświęcim, at about 9 o'clock at night, behind schedule, make a wrong turn, and in the middle of turn here, I made a left turn, hadn't gotten but 30 feet, the police car pulls up, yelling at me in Polish, in a motorcycle, and just then the rain started pouring down, he said, get out of here. He didn't want to stand in the rain. I think that the bonds that Martin and I formed with the Polish brother are one of the tightest bonds we've had in our life, and they're bonds we'll never forget. And I think probably the same is true from the Polish side. I think that we were equally appreciated there by the brother. We got very close with the Sochanics and also to the Grudzień's. Well, then in about, I'm going to guess 1982, 1983, Leo and Sarah Ruggiero decided to go down to visit their family in Argentina. Now, Marjorie had a contact of the Lamas Hill Missionary Movement in Brazil, which she always corresponded with over the years. We often talked about her. Marjorie's had great interest in Spanish language, particularly, and Portuguese all of her life. At least all of her adult life. I don't know if as a kid, but as adult life she did. So, Leo and Sarah came back, and they had met the Lupsar family. And they were wildly enthusiastic. They just said this is the greatest family, and they really enjoy them, especially Lazar Lupsor, which is the grandfather of Christina. And they really want somebody else to go down there to follow through. And so I like travel. I said, yeah, we'll skip Europe next year and go to South America. We were going to Europe every year. So we decided to go to South America. And we wanted to include Brazil. So we started out in Curitiba, Brazil. And there we met with the layman's class. Big class, about 100. That were there at a big meeting hall, their own church building. And, went back to the hotel room that night, and we got a visit from a brother, Batola Fonseca. Now, the head of the laymans at the time was a brother Trush. His sister at that time was a brother Fonseca, Miguel Fonseca. And this was Miguel's nephew. Miguel's nephew was Batola Fonseca. And he came, and he was very upset that we visited his brother. He said, these brothers don't see the truth. He sent a very bitter letter to the Don about these brothers. And the Don had showed me the letter. And I just thought, no, this brother is so radical, such an attack, and so evil speaking, I don't even want to see him. But since he came to the hotel room, he said we had to see him. And I was much more impressed. Quite impressed, in fact. Not 100% yet, but definitely enough to say with two sides of the story, and I'm willing to listen to both sides. Then we went on to Argentina, and Lázaro Lupfer was near the end of his life, but meeting him was a joy, and we all agree the Lupfer family was fantastic. At that time, we also met a brother, Ramon Fisani, from Rio de Plata, down by the Atlantic Ocean, and he was a brother that blessed us very much. We met a few other brethren, and there was a new group that they were starting to witness to. It was a town called Barzitege, or Barzitege, I don't know how to pronounce it. And this group, signed when we were there, as ones who were coming into the truth, but not really developing. So we were impressed with the number in Argentina. In Brazil, we were there. We also visited a German brother, another Vailand, in Presidente Getulio, which is in the German sector, and then down the Atlantic coast in a resort town of Sister Amelia Cremar. And these were all highlights to us. So we decided that we would alternate. We'd go to South America 1 year, Europe 1 year, South America, Europe. I only have 3 weeks vacation. We had to be careful how we used it. And we'd just keep going back and forth. About this time is when the daughter of Brother Abel Lupsor, who spoke very good English with our translator, showed enough interest that we decided to invite her to America. And she came up and we had a very, very good time with her. But she wanted to go back because she was engaged to Oscar Kupernan. And we were upset about that because he wasn't in the truth. But he's come along to the truth now very nicely. And she's still very active in the truth. There's another young girl there, Brother Milo Lupsor's daughter. She was about 10 to 11 years old at the time, Christina Lupsor. And when she was 17, she came and said, "Can you sponsor me to come to America?" And I thought, well, I never spent this goal before. Come up and ask me to sponsor them. But yes, we'll do it. So as soon as she got past her 18th birthday, she was on the plane. And she came up. Has a lot of interesting stories to tell as she got here. Of course, it's Christina Palicki now. But it's become one of our daughters. We become very close to her. Others from Europe have come over. And I think they've tightened the bond also that we've had. We were so surprised when Dark Sivek won the lottery and came over that. That was a great pleasure. And there were very other, the twins were very special when they came. So with Chris and Marta, we had asked Chris to come. We met him at the International. And in Poland, the year before he came, and he said, "You know, I think a person who would like to visit America sometime is a sister, Marta Zubala. Maybe you'd like to invite her for a few weeks." Fine. Sure. So I didn't know her. He introduced her to me. Then I get here, and Renata Regala was living with me. "You know who that Marta is?" So that's Chris's girlfriend. He didn't bother telling me that. They got engaged while they were here, and naturally it's the wedding. One of the other experiences that grew out of this experience was with Ella Jakosz. That was probably the most unusual of all the experiences we had with the Polish brother coming over. Renata had gotten a letter when she was living with us about her friend from camp in Poland, Ella Jakosz, being in like a house prison situation in Detroit. She came over to live with relatives, and that they wouldn't let her see any of the brethren. They were keeping her from everything. And that when her mother asked her to come back, she didn't want to go back to Poland. And they're concerned for her. And my feeling was, well, we can't do much about it. That's her choice. If she wants to stay there and be a prisoner, stay and be a prisoner. That's her choice. I didn't know who she was. But Renata kept begging me. And Stanley Zonierski had visited her, and he recommended we try to do something. So we made a trip to Detroit, and it was like visiting a prison house. This house where she lived in a nice suburb area, all black in front of the windows. We walked around to the backyard, and Ella was in the backyard. And when she saw Renata, she talked to her so lovingly. But as soon as this woman said, "Ella, come in," she went in. That was it. We couldn't get any closer. So then I dropped the case. I said, we can't do a thing. But at the same time, Ella Matisik had come from Bielwa Guard to live in New York. And she was in Detroit. We decided to meet her. And Ella wanted to learn English, so she came to live with us. And she pleaded Ella's case. She knew Ella very well. And so, again, it warmed up as we'll try. We went there with Ella. And they also met. But when it came to shove, So he wouldn't go on. He said, come and spend the Christmas holidays with us. You can go back. Well, I'll do that for so long. No, I don't dare. I love my Uncle Nat too much that she wouldn't leave. So finally, I told him, and I said, the only possible thing we can do yet is bring her mother. If she turns her mother down, that's it. I give up. So we invited the mother, and the U.S. government turned the mother down. They wouldn't give the mother a visa. So I washed my hands of it. That was it. At the International Convention that year in Wilmington, Lisa comes up to me and said, Groves. I said, I think you should try one more time with the sister. And I said, I don't know. I don't think that's going to work. No. At least talk to the sister. So I talked to Grishina. And I still was not impressed that it would work. And I thought, well, let's see what can happen. And if I said, it won't hurt, I don't want to be involved. If somebody else would invite her, okay. And Alice Snyder said she would invite her. So Alice invited Grishina to come over. Right away, the Polish guy came and said, you're making a mistake. All Grishina wants to do is stay in the United States. She won't come back. And I said, I don't care. If she can get her sister out of this, then it's worth it. It's her choice. She wants to stay in America. I'll help her. And so that doesn't bother me. So Grishina came, went to Detroit with Grishina, and it was like a scene out of a movie. We had David Liprot, had Grishina in his car. Roger Adams lived in there. He parked on the side street. I knew they knew my car, so I parked up the street half a block. There's no answer. We waited for them to come home, wherever they were. The neighbor came out and came to us and said, you've got to save that girl. She's a captive in the house. So I gave a little courage. And she said, well, so as soon as she goes in that garage, immediately the garage door goes down. She closed it on her way in. And Roger said, I can handle that. So after about half an hour, in comes the car into the garage. Roger tailing right on the, almost at her back end. And she comes out of the car screaming, thinking he was going to be held up or robbed or something. What are you doing here? And Ella was screaming at Roger. And then Grishina walks out. And Ella broke down. Tears. And I said, Grishina. And it was like a family reunion. And it was such a beautiful scene. But when Grishina finally came and said, leave with us. No, I can't. She wouldn't leave. Still there. So Grishina said, I'll stay in Detroit. I know where she's going to school. And I said, I'll see what I can do. So Grishina went down early, met the teacher. The teacher said, get that girl out of that situation. And so Grishina and her sister met at school every day. Well, finally, Christmas break came. Grishina told Ella, hey, Christmas with us. No, I can't. My aunt won't let me. If your aunt means more to you than your family, I don't want anything more to do with it. She turned to leave. And Ella said, I can't do that. I need you too much. And she wanted to hang her sister. And Grishina hung tough. She said, it's us, your family, or the aunt. You choose. This is my last day here. It's your choice. Okay, I'll come. Now, not more than come. You've got to call the police and tell them you will not go back to that house. And she did. I was at a meeting at Endless Committee at Matheson's when I got the call from David Woodbrook. She's free. And I just broke down tears. It was such a happy day in our life. And, of course, she moved in. Stayed with Woodbrook for a while, but they couldn't keep it for long. They're small children. So we took her in here. Had the double wedding of Ella and Mark Chastain and Chris and Mark at the same time. On one of our trips to Europe, when we were with the Kate Bonds down in Bavaria, Sister Eva Hensel from Hanover, Germany, came down to visit. And as we were eating dinner up in the mountains and discussing the various activities around the world, she mentioned her correspondence with the brother Bailan and the sister Graymar in Brazil. That story is one of the more interesting ones to me. Sister Hensel, she was Sister Dortmund, met Sister Graymar back when Sister Hensel was very young, still a teenager. When Sister Hensel graduated from high school, she gave a set of volumes to her neighbor, to the Graymars. Graymars were not interested in the volumes. They took the books as a kindness, put them in the shelves, let them sit. A few years later, they moved to Brazil. In Brazil, they kept the volumes and didn't do a thing about them for years. Their family grew up, had children, and the children married. And many years later, 30 or 40 years gone by, Sister Graymar got very sick and would be hospitalized. for a long period of time. Being bored in the hospital, she talked to her husband. She says, years ago, when I was back in Germany, Ethel Hensler gave me some books. They're still on the shelf. I never read those books. Can you bring them in? Within a few weeks, she read all six volumes. Absolutely thrilled with them. Said, this is the truth. The Graymars are fairly well-to-do. And so they started placing advertisements in the German language newspaper. About 60 miles away, in the city of Presidente Getulio, was a German brother, Helmut Weiland. He saw the ads. He went over to visit her. He baptized her in the Atlantic Ocean. When Sister Graymar first got interested in the truth, she began writing to Sister Hensel, telling about her interests. Sister Hensel began writing her a letter every week, taking a different doctrine and explaining them in depth. After the first one or two letters, Sister Graymar told her about Brother Weiland. So Sister Hensel wrote two letters a week. One to Sister Graymar, one to Brother Weiland. Every week, instructing him the truth. Brother Weiland, at this time, had heard the truth back in the old country, back in the days shortly after Brother Russell's death. But he never saw the concept of the Lord's second presence. As a result of the letters, he began to see the presence. He believed it. He started placing ads in the papers. He got a class going. And provided a little German class in that little city of Presidente Getulio. We met the last member of that class before he died. On one of our visits to Brother Weiland, we asked him about these letters. He went to his bedroom, went out a shoebox. It had to be at least 14 inches long. Crammed these letters, each one filed by date, each one numbered. Then he had a book indexing the whole thing. This doctrine, this letter, letter 46, letter 22, whatever it might be. They were like a set of volumes to him, handwritten. That's just an insult. Now let's leave that story there for a second. In the city of Union Victoria, Brazil, was a brother Eric Will. Brother Eric is originally from Kiel, Germany. He heard the truth in 1917 from a discourse by Judge Rutherford. His father, who was an atheist, moved the family shortly thereafter to Brazil. His mother and his brother were also believers, but his mother died shortly after he got to Brazil. 2 years later, his brother died. He felt that he was the only one left with these views. He kept looking for the Bible students. He found the Jehovah's Witnesses. He went to their meetings. He was dissatisfied. So this is not. He asked the witnesses, what happened to the Bible students? Well, they've all died. So then he knew that he was the last Bible student in the world, just waiting for the end to come. One day when he was downtown, he met a local Lutheran minister. And the Lutheran minister asked him, said, where do you go to church? He said, I don't go to church. But you believe the scriptures? Oh, yes, I believe the Lord. Why don't you go to our church? I couldn't because I can't agree with your doctrines. And he witnessed to the minister and said, well, I can see what you mean. You don't agree with us. But you need fellowship. All Christians need fellowship. You're alone. Come to church and lose fellowship. So he said, well, I'll try that out. And he went, he was received very warmly. A small church, about 40 people. He went there Sunday after Sunday. After a year was up, the minister said, you've got a better knowledge of the Bible than anybody else in this church. Will you take the Sunday school class? Well, I couldn't do that. I don't believe what you're teaching the children. And so that is a problem. But you know, there are enough Bible stories we agree on. Can't you at least start them with the Bible stories? Well, if that's what you want, fine. Brother Will was an artist. His works are quite famous throughout Brazil. He's a top name artist in the country. He drew a picture, painted a picture, in the Brazilian forests. Typical Brazilian trees in the background, two woodsmen on a hillside, a tree cut down between them, down in the valley a church, up on the hill across the way, a little graveyard. A parade of parishioners are going from the church to the graveyard. And Brother Will would take this to Sunday school. And see, now this picture illustrates what the church teaches and what I believe. He said, the minister has told the people that this man who's died is more alive than ever. He's taken to bury the remains. The two woodsmen on the hill know better. They know the scripture in Ecclesiastes, as a tree falleth, so shall it lie. The dead tree. And they work from that into a resurrection sermon. That was about the most he could do. After perhaps 30, 35 years, the minister retired. He told Brother Bill, he said, well, I'm leaving the ministry. I'm retiring. Will you take the pulpit? Brother Bill said, oh, can I take the pulpit? You know what I believe. do what like you've been doing in Sunday school. Teach the simple Bible stories. So he started doing that, and people loved his ministry in the pulpit. Then one year, 2 or 3 years later, the congregation in America appointed a new pastor. The new pastor met with the will and said, "You're teaching heresy, get out of the church." They forced him out of the church after all these years, some 40, 50 years of faithful service at the church. About the same time, Brother Will had written an article for a German language paper. Brother Will's daughter had been cured from a disease by an herbal remedy. And this was a health article about how this remedy cured his daughter. But he quoted two scriptures in the article. Brother Weiland, who lives across the mountain range, read the article in the paper. And Brother Weiland never missed an opportunity to write letters to people write articles. The article was Mr. Will and said, "You may not believe this, but this is not the time for healing. That's in God's kingdom." Will read the letter and he wrote back to Weiland and said, "What you write sounds like Russellism." Weiland wrote back, "It is." Weiland said, "I'm a Russellite too." Will wrote back, "I'm also." He found his first Bible study in 40, 50 years. Brother Weiland at this time was too sick to travel, so they never met. Brother Weiland alerted Brother Ponsaka. Brother Ponsaka went down to visit him. And when we were in Brazil, Brother Ponsaka was visiting him, so we went on down to see Sister Graymar and then Brother Weiland. Brother Weiland and Brother Ponsaka calls, all enthused about Brother Bill. Said he's really got the truth, he sees it well, everything is beautiful. We had Rick Buss with us and Roberta, and Marge and myself, and we said, "Let's go to the Uni Victoria. We've got to meet this brother." Now, just before this, the Dawn had finished printing for the first time a Portuguese verse 5. We had about 10 copies with us. So we went down there and met with the Bill. He's a man who's 80 by this time, not in the best of health, but delightful. And he saw the first time when Mark brought one in, and tears came in his eyes. He said, "Can I get 50 copies of this? I want to give a copy to every member of the church." So we said, "Yes, we'll call the Dawn." And we called the Dawn, and they sent 50 copies. We got a letter from Brother Bill about 3 or 4 weeks later, saying that I got the books and I'm starting to distribute them. In the meantime, Sister Tetzel heard about Brother Bill. So we started writing a third letter. She couldn't keep out 3 letters, so she made it a Robin Oppen letter. It was sent from one to the other, instructing them in the truth. They made copies for each other. We didn't hear from Brother Bill again until Christmas time. He sent a Christmas card. He got a reply back from his daughter. He said, "My father died last month. The day before he died, he delivered the last one of those volumes to the parishioners. His work was finished, and he was at home." Very beautiful story how the Lord's evil power is there. The last area in overseas travel that meant a lot to us was in 1990. A letter had been received by Sister Alta Caterva that they were brethren in Romania. And they did not know their brother in America. Brother Simofi from Ontario, Canada, had made the contact with the Romanian brethren, telling about the brethren here. Sent the pictures of the brethren, he can report to the convention. Sister Betty Pecupi got this and wrote the files is true. I was enthused, Alpha was enthused, the Dawn was enthused, Brother Beloga was enthused. So the Dawn immediately sent Brother Beloga and Brother Debski on a trip there to scout out this new area of service. In the meantime, I decided we would also go, but we couldn't go at the same time. So they went, they brought back a good report, and we went for 2 reasons. Well, one reason was to encourage them, but the more important reason was to bring those who could come to the International Convention. We had room in our vans for some who could come. Shirelle was going to bring them back to Romania. And so Sister Betty Pacoop, Brother Cornell and Sister Marie Brie, and Brother Cornell
Igreot,
and Brother Jan Galish came with us. We went to Cluj. That's a very large class in Cluj. Went on to Baia Mare. Met the brethren there. Had car trouble there. The brethren fixed their car. By Spree, met a few brethren there. Siget, the suburb, I think it's called a nest in the suburb of Siget. But it's a large class up in the mountains. In fact, we're up there in the mountains and, we're talking about the meeting is in Romania during the successful years. And so we'd always meet in the early afternoon because we had to go home by 4 o'clock. And we asked why. They said, that's when the wolves come out. It's not safe for us. This brethren we're staying at live out in the country. You know, farm yard, they got a barn up back. The only bathroom facility is in the barn. I'm on diuretics, so I gotta go to the bathroom frequently. So middle of the night, I gotta go to the bathroom. So I get out, as I'm crossing the barnyard, I just said I see this white animal sneaking across, and how, uh-oh, there's a wolf here. I was getting pretty nervous. I went to the bathroom, came back, and the animal was still there. And he goes, perf, perf, perf. Little dog. In my mind, it was much more than a dog. The brother showed us the prisons where they've been held. Remember the NC who did the printing during the war. We met Brother Budu, who was the one that translated the Romanian volumes from French into Romanian language. Had a picnic up in the Transylvanian mountains. And there we had a fantastic study and discussion, as well as just playing games with the children. And Brother Negret, which she enjoyed, he was one who'd been in prison for, I think, 5 or 8 years under Ceausescu. And we asked him who took the detention. And so whenever the tension got too bad, I'd sing a hymn. Well, later we were on the way back to the International Convention, and we got entered Austria, and of course, immediately, I could step on it. And so I started driving about 80, 90 miles an hour, and Brother Negri, I leaned back and sang hymns. I went back one more time to Romania. My last trip overseas, except for International Conventions, was in 1991, shortly before I became paralyzed. I was to go and look over the new site for the International Convention at Poitiers, France, and then to take a trip with Sammy's daughter, Anique, and Nicholas Chartres from England to visit the brethren in Poland, Finland, and Romania. Already my legs were starting to bother me quite a bit. I was having a lot of stumbling problems, a lot of falling problems. My health was declining pretty fast on this trip. So I got on the train to meet the Stauders. I wasn't sure I could make the trip. I just was starting to fall. In fact, the day before I left, I told Margaret, I said, I can't make it. I'm just too far down. But I woke up the next morning and said, I feel pretty good today. I'm going to try it. So we, Nicholas quickly saw me stumbling off the train. He came and grabbed my bag. We took the next train up to Hanover to the Hensel. And then we changed trains for Stockholm, Sweden. And in Stockholm, I had a name there, Brother Anders Carlén, who I'd corresponded with, who'd been to the pyramid with the Edgar brothers. And he met us, and we had a nice discussion with him, went to his apartment. Took the boat from Stockholm to Helsinki, Finland. And there we met by the Nordmans. And they went to his parents' house, and that was delightful. We had 3 days of nothing but studies. They had all the brethren there from Finland, most of them who did not agree with the Nordmans, and they... It was a real quizzing, and we had a real opportunity. Brother Timo Nordman is one of my heroes. He's from southern Finland originally, but he went to college in Oulu, which is in the north, up near Lapland. And he's a bodybuilder. He very much into physical fitness. And in the gym, he met Sirpa, who became his wife. And when they were going together, I don't believe engaged yet. I think he just dating. He brought her to meet his parents. His parents, right behind their house, is a railroad yard. And as they were talking, he noticed a spark from the line overhead hit the chemical car. And he says, that's going to burn up. So I got to cap that car. So he rushed to get on top of the train to cap the car. And just then another spark came and the car exploded with him on top. And it was hurled like a ball of fire through the air. Sirpa saw this. And she watched enough Western movies that as soon as he landed, she quickly got a bucket of sand and started throwing sand at him. To put out the fire. He was burned over something 80% of his body. Whether he survived or not was questionable. But because of his extreme health training, his body was strong enough. He survived nothing but a scar on his arm or this whole thing. And of course he got married. Timo is under the tutelage of Michael Nikorup. And he's started his own magazine all by himself, he and Sirpa. They got a distribution of about 100 names. A very active witnessing magazine advertising, a remarkable couple. They had a very nice visit. From there we went down to Poland, to the Grudzins. Just spent 2 days there. and then on to Romania, again to Cluj only this time. And this time, both Anik's daughter and I had it. And we had two invalids and two healthy people coming back. But the last trip was a worthwhile trip. I was very glad I made it. It solidified bonds with Romania. I've been very interested in Romania since. And in Poland as well. But let's get off the travels. Let's go to another area of the Spirit of the Lord has given me. In the late 1950s, I became very enamored with the ministry of Brother John Megason. His talk thrilled me. If he was anywhere within 150-mile area of Chicago, or 200-mile area, Marge and I would, after work, we'd drive down, hear him talk, drive backwards the next day, catch the next place he went. We'd catch him in Muncie, Indiana one day, and Fort Wayne the next day, and Grand Rapids the next day, and I would just follow him around. I just learned so much, so enamored with his knowledge of the truth, that it woke in me a desire to really sit down and study. So in 1959, I asked Brother Megason, would you lead a 2-week series of studies leading me through the truth? And I think a few others would like to attend them also. Because I was getting, by this time, interest with the young people. But they offered Birds of a Nursing in Chicago, Mary Wessel and Tom Hack and a few other those of that age group. And but Mason said yes. We went together to a convention in Fort Worth, and en route, the other brother in the car discouraged him, said, this was not a class sponsor project. You create problems. He didn't recommend he do it. So Brother Megason bowed out. So I don't want to cause any problems. By this time, I was really enthused about the idea of a 2-week intensive study camp. So I talked to Marilee and Alice and Marilyn Binda and Rebecca Hack and her sister. As I talked to these, I realized we can do it anyway. We just need leaders. I've been very close to Brother Wadham all my life. I asked Brother Wadham, he would lead a study a day for 2 weeks, 2-hour studies. I asked Brother Sunbaum, he would lead a study a day. We're still short a leader. I asked Alfred Burns. That was longer for 1 week, but not 2. So I asked Dean Burns, and Dean took the other week. Dean took 1 week and Alfred. And then Jack McCauley visited once during the 2-week period. But now we needed a place. We didn't know where to go. The opposition in Chicago was very great. This idea of the young people having a camp without the class organizing, if that was a taboo, was just not to be done. So I knew you'd get no help from Chicago. In fact, the opposition was very strong. But there was one elder from out of town, and the opposition to Dawn, by the way, was even stronger. This was awful at my seminars. But Brother Steve Roskowitz was not opposed. He said, that sounds like a good idea. You can have my cottage. And he had the cottage in Bostwick, Lake Michigan. And the first seminar was only for consecrated. You had to be consecrated to go. Its object was purely study. There were two 3-hour, 1 2-hour study a day. Maybe 3 2-hour studies a day. First time in the lake, it was on a lake, and water ski, swim, testimony meetings. Some beautiful experiences were held there. It so enthused me that I went to the greatest study period of my consecrated life. For the next year and a half, I was intent on studying the scriptures. I was just so wound up by the seminar. It really done a lot for me. But we couldn't do another one because it was just taboo. It just opposition was very great. There was one elder in Chicago who was very wise, and he said, Carol, let the wind blow. Just don't react. Put your head down. The time will come. That's right. I'll let you know when that is. And that was Brother Julius Bednarz. 5 years later, 1965, Julius and I were on the Young People Committee. He said, the time has come. Let's do it. And so we put on the first Young People Seminar. It was sort of the forefront of the camps today. And this was in a little town north of Winnipeg, Canada, Parkersburg, Canada. Very rustic town. Mark Cannon and I slept in the station wagon because there was no room in the inn. Mark would drive me to the bathroom every morning. It's like deluxe service. But the studies went great. The next year we moved to Beauséjour, Ontario, and that was the most rustic. Big holes in the ceilings, bugs would drop in any other night, the rain would come, you get all wet. But who cared? We had a great time together. We studied together. Then we moved to Michigan. We moved to Kandahar Barn in Grayling, Michigan. And that was a civilized place. And that's where they really started growing. We got there. And then from there up to the Buick camp in Walloon Lake, up a little further north in Michigan. It wasn't long after we started these that Brother Ken Ross had started equal camps on the East Coast, where they were there in the Pocono Mountains. And so even today, there are the East Coast camps and the Midwest camps, and the Chicago Seminar. There are three, and they've grown from the 30 or 40 that we used to have to 100, 130 of the summer camps and 91 this year at the winter camps. We had one policy that we held because the opposition, as I said, was very great. We finally got those who were opposed would say, I won't listen to you come once. If you come once, I'll listen to you. But now you don't know what you're talking about. And almost everyone who came became a convert. And they became enthused of the camps. I know several examples along that line became very active in the camp work. At this time, Dan Larson was living out in New Jersey, so he got involved in East Coast camp work and brought that concept back to the Midwest. After this first one was privately sponsored, the first one was purely our idea. We personally appointed the leaders and did it ourselves. Then it was a class sponsored project after that. It was under class leadership. I think the youth camps, I've had mixed emotions over the years. One of the strong opponents of the youth camps was Albert Chappelbaum. And Albert and I were always close friends. We would talk well. And Albert's main objection, he said, what you're doing to these kids is wrong. He said, you're getting them to enjoy this new approach to scripture studies, exciting approach, seminar approach. Things that you see in college today, they'll never be happy to regular meeting again. And he's partly right. And that's been my mixed emotion. It's been, are we integrating young people or are we separating young people? And that was Albert's fear that we're separating them. And that is a fear I hold to this day that maybe it's true. And yet I see the good that comes out of camps and I can't deny it. But there's been an awful lot of good that's there. So I just sit back and said, Lord, you be the judge. I'll never judge which is the right, which is the wrong. Also in the 60s, another project came up that was very, very close to my heart. We noticed how many brethren were lacking the tools of the Bible study movement. They didn't have the reprints. They didn't have the other books of Brother Russell. And so we got thinking about the idea, maybe it's time to reprint these books. But how to do it? Can we do it? The size of the project almost scared us. So we decided first to consult with brethren who would probably take the opposite viewpoint that we had. I found over the years, whenever I get involved in something, the most successful way to get involved is not find somebody who's going to agree with me, but somebody who's going to disagree with me. And that way there's a check and balance system. And so I picked Edmund Jesuit as the other person. And Edmund is a person who doesn't turn you off. He listens carefully. He says, well, do you have a real case? Can you prove a need? I said, well, let's find out. Went to the Dawn first. And I said, we've already checked it out. There's a need for two sets. Well, hardly enough to reprint reprints. I went to the Watchtower next in Brooklyn. Talked with the AWs. So these are your books too. How many do you want? Well, we want them, we'll print them. We don't need your presses. We can do it ourselves. I went to the Lamas Home Missionary Movement. Dr. Brother Jolly at the time. Brother Jolly first quiz rested in High Calling. We got that all cleared away, and still we're good friends. And he said, I think we have a need in our movement about 30 or 40 sets. So I think we could definitely, I'll commit us to 50 sets. We'll buy 50 sets if you do it. So then I went to Brother P.L. Reed from the Herald. And Brother Reed said, well, our movement's dying out. He said, there aren't very many brethren left their order. Most of them have reprints. But count us for a large donation for doing the work. I said, we'll send you $2,000 to $5,000 to get you started and help you out in the work. So the cooperation was minimal. And we finally went to the class and asked the class, can we take the survey on the basis that there's 200 orders? We'll try doing it. If the less new letter, we'll drop the project. And they said yes. They would authorize that because that didn't involve any big expenditures or money. So we put out a nationwide survey among the brethren. And we had, within a short time, about 380, 390 orders. But it says, what will it have to print? So the class was going to authorize, but Edmund and I were the committee to do this checking. And so I told Edmund, I said, Edmund, I may be bold, but the orders are still coming in. The class had authorized you print 25 over the number ordered. It says, there's 390 ordered, 25 over is 415. I think we should bid 700 cents. I said, no, 1,000. I said, Edmund, you're crazy. You're supposed to be the conservative. I'm the liberal here. We're on the wrong side of the fence. He said, it'll be there. Just trust me. So we had the fast authorization. They spent 300. We printed 1,000. Now, there was a steps leading up to this. How to print, where to print, who to print. So we decided the first thing we do was take a smaller book and print that. See the qualities of a commercial printer, how the prices were. I found out through the grapevine that there were a lot of printers in the Ann Arbor, Michigan area. So I took a trip to Ann Arbor, found three printers, and took along with me two books, The Manna and the Breed and Comets, the original Breed and Comets. And they came back with a price, and Edmund agreed that we should do it. The representative of Chicago was a man named George Milan. So I called George Milan and said, I have an order for you. I need 400 of the book, The Berean Comets, and 400 of the book, The Daily Heavenly Manna. Book you can pick up at my house anytime. He said, fine, you got your address down. How's John Reed doing? Blue. He went to the Bible said name. He's doing pretty good. I just saw him last week. Now he's by 98 now. He said, enough, everybody's doing okay. How about Ben Hollister? My mind. I said, how'd you know these people? I used to go to your meetings. My mother's a Bible student. She was in the Herald class. She's in Atlanta, Georgia now. I said, my father's Catholic. We take mom to the meeting. Dad and I go down to Lincoln Park Zoo. Take a look afterwards. I said, I still remember coming across the street one day downtown and pick up mom, and there was a mom standing with Brother John T. Reed. I said, he was always dressed so impeccably with this, always had a vest and a suit on. He said, it looked like the perfect English gentleman. And he was sitting there with his vest and suit. As I came up, he reached in his pocket, pulls out a switchblade, and closes his fingers and nails. He said, somehow it didn't match. He said, I was so surprised. He said, Dad, I used to go to the racetrack. And it was Ben Hollister at the racetrack. And they got talking about his mother. He said, you know, what do you give an 80-year-old mother who's got everything? Another nightgown. I said, I don't know what nightgown she got. So, he said, 2 years ago, I gave her a nightgown for Christmas. He said, oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad to get this. I need it. John Reed's coming to town. It seems so funny coming in that context. But anyway, go back to the printing. He printed them. Quality was decent. We were not overly impressed. We didn't know where to go next. I'd heard through Brother P.L. Reed that the Herald was printing at the Church of the Abraham Faith in Oregon, Illinois, that they were impressed with the European Herald magazine. So I went down there to Oregon to check out their prices. And the Swedish gentleman there, very nice gentleman, he looked at the books and he said, a bit on this. He said, you know, my mother used to love these books. She said, yeah, she was a Bible student. And so, once again, you know, you never know who you're going to need along the way. But his price was high, and we didn't know what to do. We finally took the lowest price, which was Ann Arbor. And then George Tabak came up and he said to the elders, and he said, brethren, this is a good price. I recognize that. But once it's done, we spend all this money, and it's done. I'll make a proposition to you. I will buy a press. I will print for exactly the same price as your lowest bid. I'll make the books 10% larger, guarantee a better binding, so you get a superior quality, and I use all the profits to pay for the press so we can print tracts and other materials. And that's how Bible Center Publication started, as an outgrowth. But before doing this, he had a little press that printed 2 sheets at a time, 6,000 pages. Big job. Who's going to do the printing? So I made arrangements for Larry and Alice Schneider to live for a year in Chicago, pay them $250 a month, whatever. But they paid for an apartment out of that, a small apartment, to send them up to live on, and then printed 20, 30 pages a day. And then we had these single pages, four-page sheets, 2 pages on this side, 2 pages on the other side. Now they'd be put into a 6,000-page book. So Brother Ed Zick made toll-day holders of these, a bunch of them. They were about, oh, that we call 10 tiers high, and I think with 10 long, about 100 tiers. Each of these holding 4 pages. We'd take 10 brethren down there, and they'd collate these as you go through, come right down the stack, pass it on down, a regular assembly line system. At the end was the shaker that George still uses to shake things for the press. And then they go to a group of checkers who go through and make sure all the pages were there. And, it was about 20 every time we finish a book. And then we take them to the binder and get them bound. And, that's how the reprint started. Now we get all the commercially, they do the whole job, but we have the press, and the press has worked for how many hundreds of brethren, other than the brethren. It's been a big asset, and now it's worth the publishing. And the publishing didn't stop with the reprints. After we did that, then we started looking for other books that were the Russell. I had read someplace that, oh, it says a library, that's where it was, a downtown library. And I was researching something else when I came across an article by the Russell in the Overland Monthly magazine. And I found there was one every month. And so we got photos at the library, and we got these done. Then we needed to do the typesetting for the Harvest Gleaning, all the tracks. So it's a Charlotte Coppersmith, but painstakingly go through, and we now duplicates already in the towers. And then crew of basically Bruce Cunningham especially, but Joy also would do the typesetting at her house on these old antiquated typesetting machines. Paid $1,000 for them, but they worked. They're all done in ribbons of tape. The first ones. Computers want to get on the scene. But we got the Harvest Gleaning 1 done. Harvest Gleaning 2 and 3 were done on the computer. Chris Snachinski took that over and handled the work on the computer. Sermon book. Did a lot. One of the outgrowths of the work, not directly connected, because the publishing work is strictly through the class. The outgrowth was not through the class. The outgrowth was in 1998. In 1998, we were due to make a trip to see my parents in Portland, Oregon. In January, and we had invited Sister Charlotte Adams, who was with us, and Esther Tosha Nalmazera was visiting her sister Claudia, and I said, if you can take 3 weeks, we'll take you on this trip also, see part of America. So she wanted to go. She flew back from Phoenix for it, and then we got a call from Sister Adams. She couldn't make the trip. This was the day before we left, so I turned to Jeff, and I said, Jeff, would you like to go along? I'm so much, got so much to do, I can't go on. Let me think about it. Next morning, well, I'll go in one consideration. I don't want you to tell Sarah I'm going. Well, that's not, you're going to be in the same car, it's the other one anyway. Okay, I'll play along with it. So in the morning, we get ready to go on the trip, and I asked Jeff to sit next to me in the passenger seat to say a word of prayer for the trip. And the boys said to get out, I start the engine and start backing off. And Sarah said, Jeff, you got to get out. And says, oh, no, I'm going. Well, that should have did it. I had to drive all the way. Jeff was sitting there. Marge sitting back with Estera. Jeff went back and haven't looked at my mirror. Had on the other and turned to Marge and said, something going on back there. Well, we get to Denver, our first stop, and I get a telegram from my brother that my mother had become very bad shape and they needed somebody to take care of her. He said, bring Sherelle back from Moldova to take care of her. Charles Moldova for teaching here. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. She's doing the Lord's work there. I want her to keep doing that. I don't feel right bringing her back. And Jeff said, I don't feel right at all. So Marge and I were talking what to do. This caregiver, that caregiver, who to call to see to take care of Mom. And finally I told Marge, well, you know, we could do it. I don't want to make commitments that can't be changed. So I told my brother, he said, no. I said, I won't accept that because Barbie didn't care you so much. She wanted time for Mom. You're here. So let me talk to Jeff. And I said, Jeff, do you mind staying for the duration? And I suppose I can. I get my computer out there so I can do my work. I said, we'll work the computer out. So he stayed. We got to LaGrange, Oregon. Blinding snowstorm. I just had the condition hurt there earlier in the day at a hospital in Boise, Idaho. And so I wasn't feeling well. I said, I'm not about to hit that snowstorm at this hour of the night. And we'd heard on the radio that the Columbia River Gorge was closed anyway. So that all traffic to Portland was stopped. So we stopped at the motel there, at the restaurant. Jeff came to me and said, you know, after you asked me to go, Esther was crying, but she wants to stay. So I said, Esther, you want to stay? Yes. Just like that. No question, no hesitation on her part. So, okay. We arranged with the center that we would stay there, and we arranged to take 2 rooms so that, in Jeff's room, we had a big computer table with 4 computers lined up, and that's where the Bible Center Library project was done in 1998 on those computers. Jeff and I were working together, but Jeff was in charge of it, and it's an outgrowth of the publishing work. It's just using a new format, and That was version one. Version two, Jeff did completely on his own. But from the response, we didn't know how many of those to make. So I said, well, let's take a chance and make 400 sets and see how they go. I think we ended up with about 1,400 only. Way over our demand. Enough sets that the profits paid for the equipment that we had to buy, which we thought would just be a donation, but came out fine. Second version has helped Jeff a little bit. So that was another feature of Savoy's work that we appreciate our involvement.
You ever said how many of those 1,000 reprints went?
I think roughly 4,000 of the 1,000 went. We had to keep printing over and over again. It was a funny episode in this along this line. I didn't want to accept the Dawn's official word, so I brought it to the General Convention Committee as a matter of business. Well, they have this elders meeting, and I was a deacon at the time, I'm an elder. And I was dying of curiosity. What was going to be happening in that discussion? So Michael Alex said, Carl, I know a little back room we can sneak in, we can listen to the whole thing. So we're going to be spies in this little back room. So we're sitting down, and they're just getting to the setting point by the reprints, and crash, my chair breaks. All the elders are rushing in. Exposed. No, the reprints has been a very, very big success. Not just among the Bible students, maybe unfortunately among the detractors of the Bible students as well. They bought a lot of sets. They use it against us. I know one place they used it against us was in San Luis Obispo, California. A member of the anti-cult movement was there, and he bought a set. And I was speaking in San Luis Obispo, and he came out to hear me. And he said, I bought that set to disprove you. But I think Russell's right. He was an open enough mind that he's converted or partially converted to set. Well, speaking of going to the retirement center for this, let me go to another phase of the Lord's service activities I've been involved in. And that is the Bible Center Retirement Center. The concept was that of Tim Krupa. Tim had the dream of a retirement center for the brethren. He asked me right away that I'd be the first one to get on board and work with him. Tim and I had several meetings at a long meeting at Cincinnati, Ohio, and in Jackson, Michigan, trying to lay out plans. We realized we'd need more than two of us to pull it off. So at Albuquerque, we invited Paul Malley and Ray Luke to join, and we had four of us. And then eventually Bob Alexander and David Bruce, a six, and Rick Bus, the seven. We had the formative meeting at Chicago Convention, and at that time the plans were to go with a center that would have a administrative manager who would operate it, and that would be Len Grice. Len had kind of accepted that. He had to pull back later. But now it was hard to raise the funds for it. This is going to cost $1 million. A little more money than we had. About $999,000 more than we had. And so, how do you get the balance of the money? That's where Brother Ray Krupa came in. Brother Ray had the contacts with some wealthy brethren in the East Coast. And pretty soon, $100,000 contributions were coming in, to aid the work. And, we knew the work was to be self-sustaining. We'd already set that pattern that the price of the units would cover the cost of building. And then the second or third turnaround would start making a profit. And then we got that far down the line. Never did because we'd gone to a rental unit instead in order to satisfy the brethren's needs. And so, the first hurdle was passed. Bob Alexander laid down guidelines. He said, if we can meet these guidelines, we should do it. And basically, these guidelines were, do we think that this is a project the Lord would be happy to have us do? Do we think it can be done? Do we think we have the willingness to do it? Do we think we have the right spirit to do it? So if we can answer those four questions, then I say go. And our legal advisor at the time was Brother Wes Kramer, and he helped us develop the original bylaws. So we had that. We had the funds. We had to find a place. And Tim found this place in Gresham, which was an old person who was selling his manor home and had plenty of acreage. And I built it. David Bruce said he would organize the building team. And a lot of brethren were involved in the building. So commercial work was done as well. Then I had to find the residents. And quickly, ones like the Langers and the Ferjuskis and Stella Hack signed on. And we had half a dozen that said immediately they would like to live there. And so the retirement center was started and was built. It went through a lot of troublous times. The board had problems with itself. There were great difficulties. It worked out. It was a learning experience in mediation. When I failed, at times I got too gruff on my viewpoint. Others failed just as badly. But tolerance prevailed. I think the turning point was when Nanette Nakora got involved. She really started really pulling it out of the depths and getting some real organization behind it and getting it going so that it has worked very well. Now there's full capacity. Right now there's two openings. There's been full capacity for a little while until it has recent deaths there. It's gone through trials. We've had two suicides at Nanette Center, which have been hard for them to take. A lot of other natural deaths. There's been turnover. There's been sickness. There's been probably getting manpower to man the kitchen to cook the food. But one by one, these problems solved. Probably another major help is Margaret Ferguski being on site. She sort of is an unnamed on-site manager. She does a fantastic job. And that's partly why they went there, was she saw it as an avenue of service. I think it served very well. In fact, it's interesting that one of the first brothers who was very opposed to the center said it was not feasible economically, that we were ripping the brethren off for going to the center, that it was not, they could do better elsewhere, was strongly opposed. His wife is now a resident there. And I find that very remarkable and a testimony to it. One of the challenges that the center faced was being in a city that had two classes. Two classes that were really quite antagonistic to each other and yet held the same basic truths. They were not classes that had divided on basic doctrine, but on prophecy, understanding, management of the situations. And the one class was at the center. And the other class seemed to be quite opposed. But gradually they have come over, worked at the center. They now have one of the weekday meetings at the center. And Darius Grigian is saying now there's even talk about the two classes merging, that their cooperation is getting closer and closer. So it's amazing what can be done by careful work. Well, let's go to another phase of activity. Back in about the 1950s, Brother Chester Sundbaum started a institution. Brother Sundbaum was a remarkable speaker. He was dry, he was not citing, but he was interesting because he played games with you. He'd make charts and jigsaw puzzles for the brethren, doing that for the brethren, he'd build a talk. Sort of the four gleams of PowerPoint, but it was done in a puzzle format. Brother Sundbaum had the habit of memorizing three new scriptures a day. By the time he died, he knew thousands and thousands of scriptures. Very clear in the truth. Married to Sister Cora, who was the daughter of one of the most prominent families of the chosen Brother Russell today, the Keene family. So a very active person. And one thing that made them very well known, he traveled throughout the country, a very well sought after speaker. And yet he always tried to be home on Sunday, because he was the only elder in Saginaw class in Saginaw, Michigan. He was offered a promotion at work. He turned it down because it would take away his time from the Lord. He said, I don't want to have a better job. I want the less work I can get. Well, he began sending out every year a calendar to the brethren on their Christmas list with a manatee for Thursday and a little comment. And this continued until he and his wife died. And then we hit a seed drop. So we brought up the Chicago class, and Chicago kept it up. And the calendar got quite elaborate after a while. They got to be full-size, all calendars and beautiful pictures on them and very nicely done calendars. But the class started feeling it was too expensive, and enough thought that it wasn't serving a real function. So they dropped it. And we didn't want to see it dropped. So we kept it going personally for the last, oh, maybe 15 years now that we've done the calendar. For a while, we were setting out, at our biggest year, we sent out 1,500 English calendars, about 300 in Romanian language, about 200 in Polish language, a few in Spanish language, some in French and some in German. So it was translated into many languages. We kept this going. We received many cards, even a lot of brethren, each individually sent little $10 gifts or contributions to help pay for it. It's not that expensive doing it small scale. I always organize it every February. And then we finish it up in October. Most of the end of the year, Margaret's still lending some out. This is in January. Most of them are out. One thing I always enjoyed because of my work situation was writing. I was a newspaper editor for a while. I enjoyed writing articles. I did that in Iowa as a teenager. Wrote a local paper there. Had some wild experiences because the Mississippi River was flooded. That was one of the stories I had to cover. And I burned out the transmission in one of the boss's cars, getting deep in the water. And went to cover, they flooded in Marquette, Iowa, where the schools were taken on the second floor of the schoolhouse, and army ducks were taken to their homes on the hillside. And it was quite an area to be a reporter. But how to put this talent to the use of the Lord's service? And with the press and George's, with the flower show that was starting, that was another activity that we were on the committee the first year we had the flower show on the fair booth work, that there was a need for tracts. So I began writing some tracts. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it very much. And then George pushed me and said, can you do a TV program? And I didn't know quite how to do a TV program. So I stalled for a couple of years. I did my first TV program, and I loved it. And I did a second. I might have done two, but I've done three. And I've loved all three of them. It's been a great challenge. God's Kingdom, God's Millennium, and Can These Bones Live?